Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We hope your Thursday is coming along just great. In the second half of today's show, we'll go to the movies, as we do each and every Thursday with our in-house movie reviewer, Matt Olean. Matt will review the movie A Real Pain, about two cousins who, at their grandmother's request, relive her history as it relates to the Holocaust, but it's also a comedy. We'll see what Matt thinks of that movie, and Dave Thompson and I, as we also do on Thursdays, will get together to review this week's news. But first, this is the time of year when all of us may be planning our Christmas shopping lists. That means heading to the store. So how do stores get us to come their way? Well, retail industry expert Adam Dumay is a technology executive that specializes in AI and how retailers use it to attract buyers. He's with me today. He's my guest. Adam, welcome to Main Street.
Thanks for having me.
Adam, I'll mention that you are a member of the Retail AI Council. What is that?
Yeah, well, it's an organization that's really focused on artificial intelligence and how it's applied to retail across both the retailer perspective, supply chain, from consumers. It's really just bringing some like-minded individuals to collaborate on a technology that's having an increasingly large impact on the industry.
I feel like I'm a puppet and that AI is kind of controlling me, telling me where I should go or where I shouldn't go. But I'm very curious if you can maybe give us the insider spotlight here on how retailers are leveraging AI this holiday season to attract us and maybe using it in ways they've never used it before.
Yeah. Well, I will start with, you're not a puppet and you're not a load, right? There are many instances where even myself, I find myself, my behavior being governed by some mechanism that I was not expecting. So retailers are getting increasingly savvy in this. And historically, they've leveraged artificial intelligence more around kind of structured transactional data. But now what's so exciting, I've been in this field 10 years, what's super exciting are all these additional modalities that they use to collect info. So instead of just looking at your transaction information, now there are devices in stores that look at density mapping and patterns of where people walk in an aisle and how long they hover around certain merchandise and selecting item A and then B and putting item A back. All these types of relationships that they're using that just probably 5 years ago, which is outside the realm of possibility. So, you know, retailers are getting savvier and savvier. And thankfully, consumers are generating all the data they need to invest in this technology and create these very personalized, timely offers.
So if I walk into this brick and mortar store, I'm just very curious, how is the retailer doing that? I don't have their app. How do they know that I'm just sitting there looking at my next purchase, either for me or for my family? How do they know? And what do privacy advocates say about all this stuff?
Yeah, and that's a great way to start. I'll work backwards on the privacy piece. Retailers know that their brand is everything. And so they want to ensure they don't encroach upon kind of personal preferences and civil liberties. And so retailers are installing with increased frequency these devices across, let's say, a footprint. And they don't see you. They see a dot, right? They don't see Adam Dumay. They see a dot and they see how this dot moves. So it's anonymized. Right. And so this idea of this person with this PII, person identifying information, that is, you won't find retailers with credibility doing that. So fear not. Right. And so what they do is they track the movements of these related, we call them entities, but related things. So if I enter, let's say, a home improvement store with my two children, they know that we're one group. Right. And so how does that one group of three respond to the material versus a group of one? Right. And so there are all these different behavioral patterns you can assess even without personalizing the entity that's creating them. I will say from a frequency and density perspective, this is happening much more across a larger swath of brick and mortar stores. So if it's not there now, it will be. And I think there's a lot of benefits to that. You know, as consumers, we want to be presented with a compelling offer and a compelling value proposition. So I go back to the home improvement store. I'm from New York City. I can't tell you one screw from the other. I have no idea once I go to these stores. And so having a person that can anticipate my presence in aisle 14, bay 5, as I'm sorting through these two, I think they're called lug nuts, would be amazingly helpful. But in order to do that, we need data. for them. We need retailers to take it into action, and that's what they're doing.
And this is because, of course, I take my cell phone into the store, regardless of whether it's in my pocket, whether I'm communicating with anyone. The store then knows that a cell phone is within its presence and can track me through the store. Is that how this works?
It's partial. There are different technologies out there. One is just, think of just the body, right? There's certain kind of heat wave signals that can be used to identify that there is a human in this space. There's certain technologies that leverage mobiles, for sure. And there's technologies that leverage multiple other modalities in between. So there's lots of different options. And the nice thing is retailers can select what is the most efficient from a cost perspective and most impactful in order to get you that deal.
Okay, so I am a consumer inside a store. What you said already kind of worries me, but okay, how can I take advantage of this opportunity? You may say that I'm in aisle 6 and someone might know, or perhaps the fact that I'm looking at a, let's say, an electric generator in that aisle, the store may know. How then does it present information to me, or how can it, or how will it in the future?
Yeah. So if you think of your neck of the woods, it's a lot chillier than where I am in Washington, D.C. So if you think of, I'll give you a bigger picture where you go into the store, and let's just say for discussion's sake, you have the app loaded. And so now the store knows that you are in this certain aisle next to the generator. It also knows what the weather is outside. It also knows what you purchased in the past. It also knows how far you've driven to get there. And so, you know, conceptually, if you've been to that website as well, now it has a real interesting perspective of your intent to purchase. And so through all these attributes, now the retailer can ascertain, well, how serious is Craig about this thing in this aisle based on all these different signals? And based on that, they can make a determination of, hey, we think that the optimal offer would include 10% discount or maybe more aggressive at 20%. But it's a factor of the physical and the digital attributes that you've created already, in addition to a lot of the anonymized data that they just pulled from their user base. So hopefully that doesn't freak you out even more, but the benefit to you would be substantial.
Here is what's going through my mind, Adam. I'm in that aisle. I'm looking at the generator, and now two of the best salesmen in the store come rushing over because they know that I am ready to go. Am I going to see that?
Well, let me ask you this. Is that such a bad thing?
I don't know.
I have my own answer, but I love your perspective. If two people come up and treat you like a person amongst this group of otherwise, you know, the store of strangers, and they provide you some instruction on the thing you're looking for and also can give you a deal that's super compelling, I think that's the definition of service. Wouldn't you agree?
I agree with that. But it really disturbs me when I don't get the best deal right away, that I have to work for it. I would have had to have searched for it, that they had to know that that's what I was looking for to get a better deal. That kind of bothers me. But that's all about marketing, right? You said that there's a threshold. It may know, and I say it in air quotes, that, hey, give this guy a 5% deal and he's going to grab it hook, line, and sinker. Or this guy needs a 22% deal and then he's going to make the purchase. So all of that data is there. How can we as savvy shoppers then really manipulate, if that's the right word, the tools that are being used by the retailer to sell a lot to us? How can we use them to get better deals then?
Yeah, I think that, and I mentioned earlier, I've been in this field for 10 years. So the past 18 months, wildly exciting. But the reality is artificial intelligence has already been leveraged by consumers for years. And so typically around price tracking. So there are tools like Karma, tools like Honey or Google Price Tracking Alert, where you're able to identify a generator, let's say, and you could look back, you know, 30, 60, 90, 120 days to see how the prices have moved up or down. And you could also set various alerts so to be notified once a price drops within your sweet spot. And these tools have been used for several years, very successfully, mind you. But what's very interesting now is there's an element of artificial intelligence that consumers can use from a price perspective. But there's also artificial intelligence to just become more informed. And what's happened over the past year is this idea of summarization. So if you go to Amazon.com or Walmart or Target, now there are these abstractive summarization tools that take these tens of thousands of reviews and boil it down to a paragraph. And you could even drill down further. So you know this is a great price for your generator, but is it reliable? Well, Let's look at the other 3,400 reviews, right? What's the warranty like? Let's look at the other 3,400 reviews. So that's an area where consumers increasingly are just becoming more informed and making better decisions for their circumstance.
But Adam, I always worry, are 3,392 of those reviews generated by a bot? How can I make sure that those reviews are real oftentimes?
Yeah, there's been a massive push over the past, particularly 9 months, from retailers. And I even throw LinkedIn in there, not a retailer, but organizations that serve as consumers that realize that part of their value proposition is a community. There's been a lot of cleanup. So you think of, you know, right around the election, massive announcements around Twitter or X, cleaning hundreds of thousands of bots off the platform. LinkedIn did the same thing. And so there's a curation method that retailers do use in order to have as high fidelity pool as possible. Is it perfect? No. But is it something that rises to the level of my personal concern? No. As I mentioned earlier, retailers' brand is what they rest on. It's where they live or die. And so maintaining that across all facets of Craig's experience is just so critical to their longevity.
I think the retailer's going to be disappointed with me, Adam. I don't like to go to stores.
Seriously, you're just poo-pooing everything.
I'm sorry.
Be jolly, Craig. What happened here?
It is. And I honestly, if I know what I want to buy, I enjoy going, but it ends about there. I'm a stereotypical guy in that regard, maybe. But I am enjoying my conversation with Adam Dumais. He's a retail industry expert, and he approaches it from the aspect of AI and how it's used to get us into the store, and how we can benefit from it, and how the retailers benefit from it. Adam, you mentioned a couple of apps previously. What are the best apps that you would recommend for us this shopping season where we can come into a store armed with maybe the best information to get the best deal?
So I gave you two buckets of apps. The first is that retailer's app. So one that'll give you, again, an additional source of reviews. That'll give you the retailer's price. But you should also supplement that with these price tracking tools. Examples are Karma, Honey, Google Price Track. I've used all of these. They have great fidelity. They give you a lot of intelligence and give you the notification you need in order to pull the trigger at the right time.
Give us the psychological thinking that retailers are using to encourage me to buy more than I intend. I remember back, I don't know, in college in a marketing class or maybe even in high school, about why the candy bars are stacked right near the exit and near the place where you check out. Well, because you're going to grab one on your way out. But it's so much more than that today.
Yeah, it is. I mean, if you just take a step back and think of this holiday season and you think of 2024, consumers are tired. You know, you had all these weather disturbances this year. I think they're about, you know, 3x normal. You had this prolonged election cycle with many twists and turns, and now you have this short holiday shopping season. And so we are tired, and retailers know that. And so some tactics that they've used, not just this cycle, but occasionally, kind of two buckets. One is urgency. Then this happened to me a couple weeks ago when I was purchasing some additional clothing, that right when I was going to press checkout, up pops a screen that offers me another shirt, which matches a pair of pants in my cart for 35%. But I only had a minute left. And so as the sweat was just coming down my brow, I pressed buy, right? They got me there. But it's this idea of an offer that's too good to pass up, right? And so that's the tried and true retailer technique. And again, in the anti-Craig mentality, I would say if it wasn't a good deal, I wouldn't have purchased it, right? But it just so happened that it was for me. And the other one is something called anchor pricing. So think of your generator example where you go to your local big box and it's offered for $1,000. Black Friday comes, it's $800. And you think that's amazing. Well, if you use some of those price tracking tools that we alluded to earlier, you would see that actually they raised the price a month ago from $850. So this probably isn't a great deal. And so some retailers, you know, some reputable, some not, to varying degrees have leveraged that in order to artificially inflate the sense of discount and the sense of pride you get in shopping. So again, it's one of those reasons why your audience should consider using some tools that are out there.
Do you have a feel, Adam, and maybe this is beyond the scope of this discussion, of which retailers really get this right, maybe ahead of the curve, do it really, really well on a national scale?
I think you can look no further than recent earnings from Walmart. Right. And without getting in too much detail, you know, they exceeded expectations. They raised outlook. And once you dig into the numbers, what you see is their e-commerce presence jumped through the roof. And a component of that is the level of investment they've made in their technology stack, including artificial intelligence, some pretty creative things they've been doing around the things like a metaverse type of store, different engagement points that that consumers can leverage, and different personalization strategies and chatbots that can really engage. And so given the scale that they operate and the data they have at their disposal, it's no surprise, but it is pretty amazing once you look at a company like Walmart and the impact they're having on consumers. And I venture to wager the impact they're going to have this holiday season.
You have a really good feel of holiday season 2024 and how AI is used. Adam, what's going to change in 2025 or 2026?
Well, first thing that's going to change is Craig is going to be a much more jolly consumer shopper after this conversation.
I'm a happy guy, Adam. I really am.
Tell that to your local generator salesman. Right. I think the other part that's going to change next year, it's really an enhancement more than a pivot, is the level of personalization. The degree to which retailers can consume this data, leverage it, and create these very compelling value propositions, the efficiency and effectiveness is just going to go through the roof. We're really heading into the world where retailers are really going to understand behavior and make our lives easier by identifying really attractive offers. I think we're going to see that more and more into 2025 and after.
I think I've seen examples of where we walk into a store and the advertisement is in aisle 6. I walk by it and it's showing something that I like. Later on, my wife walks by the same and is displayed an ad that is maybe targeted to her. Is that coming down the line or is that already here?
That's already here. You know, there's an element of geofencing that takes place, absolutely. And that's going to get more and more attractive. You know, if I pivot a little bit, we've been talking about the in-store experience. And this year, for example, 65% of all Black Friday shopping will happen in store. So that's not going away. But every year, more and more folks do things over the web and over their mobile devices. And that's where the level of personalization, when paired with how you and your wife engage in a brick and mortar, that's where this becomes really interesting very quickly. It's how those two different pools of data can be converged in order for retailers, again, to really understand intent and figure out how they can offer these really compelling deals.
Adam, you talked at the top of the show about stress, and then you mentioned getting an ad thrown at you with this time element of, oh my gosh, I need to really do this right now. But do retailers take that into their mind? They're inviting you to shop. Do they get it that we are stressed, and what do they do about it?
Yeah, I think I go back to the brick and mortar circumstance. Retailers want to place a large emphasis on experience. And so that has to do with decor of stores, right? I mean, I remember when I was a younger child, just the feeling of going to a mall and seeing all this red and green and all these folks that are dressed up in character, it meant something. And it really created this emotional relationship with that product. And so retailers are still looking to maintain that. And the other piece is from a labor perspective and really making sure their store is inviting. And so from a physical footprint perspective, that's really where the focus is, and that's where they really anchor on experience. On a digital side, consumers have more so than ever and increasingly every day the ability to decide when to continue shopping and when to not. And so providing that option for consumers is part of their digital strategy.
Where has ethics jumped into this conversation and where might it come into play in the future? There must be, with the use of AI, with our data, so many ethical considerations that have been considered. Where are we at in that discussion?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big, big question. The area that I think is most applicable is responsibility. So we've been talking a lot about data and how important it is to generate real high fidelity artificial intelligence for consumers' benefit. With that comes the responsibility to safeguard the information. You know, safeguard the information from intrusion, from theft and misuse. And so retailers, in terms of their internal governance processes, invest a lot of time and a lot of focus all the way to the board level to ensure the data that's being collected from consumers and the data that's being provided by consumers is treated with the highest respect. And so from a trust perspective, that is an area that retailers have always been serious about. But as we think about all the attack vectors, we think about all the technology that is available for our adversaries, retailers continually have to evolve and pivot to be ahead of the game.
We've talked about this throughout the conversation, but if you were to aggregate everything that you know and give our listeners the best holiday shopping advice, it could be with time, with using tech, with when to buy, what time of day to buy, all of those things. What is your best advice for holiday shoppers to get the best deal, to not overpurchase and succumb to those buttons that want you to make those decisions really quickly? What would you tell a shopper that really wants to get a great deal this holiday season, the best bang for their buck?
My advice, Black Friday, go to a store. You will have an amazing experience, and that's part of it, right? It's instead of staying on your computer, your mobile phone, is to get out and experience the holidays. And what we've seen from retailers already is the discounting has been higher than last year. So October, Amazon's big Prime Day event, 14% year-over-year increase in discounts. And so that's likely to continue for Black Friday, but I'm a social beast. I think it's important to go out and experience this and support your local teams. Bundle up, get out, spend some money.
I imagine that retailers are ready for us. Is there any considerations, I guess, that you want to give to us to make sure that we are having our data protected? Is there anything on the consumer side that might be a red flag or two that we just ought to really think about just to be sure? You've mentioned some great apps, and I've used some of them. They are very, very good. Is there any red flags that are out there that you want to warn us about before we wrap it up today?
I think one of the considerations your audience should factor into their shopping journey is the shared responsibility model. So we talked about retailers safeguarding the consumer data. There's a role that consumers play in taking onus of that as well. So if you go to any website nowadays, you have the ability to opt in or opt out for certain marketing campaigns, for certain cookies that are stored on your behalf. To your audience, please read that and please make the right selection, because that is as much control as you can employ in this process. And it's something, again, that retailers are looking for you to take part in.
Adam, are you concerned as we wrap it up that the small mom and pop stores that aren't affiliated maybe with the national big box stores that have all that research available to them may fall behind?
Absolutely. I think it's really hard to disagree with this idea that there's an uneven playing ground now. The nice thing about my world and artificial technology is the cost of entry are getting so, so much lower. And so the ability for folks that are not the most capitalized, that don't have the global scope to leverage some of these tools, is becoming closer and closer and closer, much closer so than we have seen in the past. So I think that gap is going to narrow, but you're absolutely right. The degree to which these mom and pop stores can forecast and maximize inventory and supply chain considerations, it's not there now, but it's getting better and better. So they should probably be in a better position in the years to come.
Retail industry expert Adam Dumais has been my guest. He's a technology executive who specializes in AI and how retailers use it to attract us, the buyers. It's a good topic for this holiday shopping season. Adam, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, readers. Ready to expand your reading list, discover fresh narratives, or simply get lost in great stories? Humanities North Dakota's One Book, One North Dakota program is like your front row seat to interviews with best-selling authors like Rebecca Claren and William Kent Kruger, two authors whose books are creating a flurry in bookstores everywhere. Learn more at humanitiesnd.org.
Coming after the break, Matt Olean will review the movie El Real Pain, and our news director here at Prairie Public, Dave Thompson, and I will review this week's news. That's after this. There's the fanfare we like to hear on Thursdays. It means only one thing here on Main Street. It's time to go to the movies with Matt Olean. Matt, welcome back to Main Street.
Hi, Craig.
Matt, this movie that we're talking about today, A Real Pain, kind of blends humor and a really tough subject. Let's listen to the trailer, and then on the backside, we'll come back and talk about it.
Your call has been forwarded to an automated voice messaging system.
Boner.
is not available.
Hey, Benji, I just got to the airport. I really hope you left already. God, you made it.
What's up, cuz?
I got some good from when we land.
Wait, you're not like taking weed into Poland, are you?
Oh, yeah.
Benji?
Nobody, they don't give that stuff. Man.
I think they very much do give
Oh, yeah. We get high in backseats of cars. Dabers and I are cousins. We used to be joined at the hip. Our grandma is from here, so Dave arranged for us to join this geriatric Polish tour with you fine people. That's the way
we get by. I really needed this man. I know that it's tough for you to leave your boy.
I don't really have anything going on.
I know it's been a tough few months for you, so...
I also want to say that I know you're not the most comfortable person with people.
I'm not?
No.
Does it look real?
Well, they're twice the size of you in metal, so...
You sure you don't want to come up here?
I'm good.
Can you take my picture?
That's what I'm talking about. Marcia!
Thank you, David.
But it's amazing that you're here, putting yourself out there so boldly for me.
Thank you, man.
Let's go smoke a joint.
Word of warning, this will be a tour about Penn.
Our grandmother and Benji were super close.
I mean, she was the coolest. I've just been in a real funk, I guess, since she died. Just haven't,
You're looking back at the horrors of your family history.
We completely cut ourselves off from anyone else's true pain.
Why are you doing this?
Oh, man, you used to, like, feel everything.
Obviously, there are triggers along the way.
We're not at the right station.
And you didn't wake me up.
Oh, you're having such a good nap, dude.
Jesus
you were like,
Christ, you're on a tour group
yeah,
with people.
I know, I just didn't have the heart to wake you up.
Has he always been like this?
I love him, and I hate him.
What the flying jeez.
And I want to be him.
You used to cry about everything.
Yeah, it was awful. Who wants to cry about everything?
We're in a Holocaust tour. If now is not the time to grieve, I don't know what to tell you.
All right, Matt, we've heard the trailer. This is a film about an American Jewish set of cousins as they travel to Poland to explore their late grandmother's Holocaust history. Comedy and then something like the Holocaust. How did that blend, Matt?
So Jesse Eisenberg wrote, directed, produced this. He plays one of the cousins, David. Kieran Culkin, in the scene-stealing role in the movie, plays Benji. Benji's the cousin. They're really close, but they've kind of drifted apart. And the grandmother died, so she leaves them in the will. She wants them to both go to Poland, okay? Benji, the Kieran Culkin character, is clearly on the spectrum. He is an erratic person. He's wired all the times. He's very manic, so sometimes he's down, then he's up, and it's very... You know, everyone's got a friend like that, right, Craig? They've got that one friend that you can't really take places sometimes because they blurt out stuff, and he does that constantly through the movie, with this tour group that they're with, okay? And it's awkward and kind of uncomfortable to watch, but kind of what happens with his blurting out of things and, you know, his musings on being in Poland and alive and all this kind of stuff kind of works out in a strange way when you see the movie. But I think Eisenberg did a really good job of walking this tightrope between kind of, it is funny. It's very funny in parts because Kieran Culkin is funny. He's this outrageous, erratic character who's over the top. And Eisenberg's character is much more subtle. He's got a job. He's got a wife. He's got a kid. He's not living in his mom's basement the way the Culkin character is. So he's the more sensible one of the two. But I think Eisenberg did a really good job blending comedy with, you know, all of a sudden they're at this concentration camp walking around, touring. And so the mood changes throughout the movie quite a bit. But I think the beats, the editing beats and the mood beats are pretty well captured because you do laugh in parts and you don't feel awkward laughing in a quote unquote, I don't even know if this is a genre, Holocaust comedy. It's kind of a strange combination, like you said, Craig, of this Holocaust tour and kind of, you know, Benji's personal problems and him saying funny things and outrageous things. But the blend actually, I think, works pretty well where it doesn't like slip over the top and become completely awkward to watch. So like the movie, I thought it was really good. I don't think it's a great movie, but it's a road movie. It's a buddy movie. You know, there's a lot of things that happen that are predictable in the film, but I like that it's an unusual story. I mean, how many movies out there are like a road buddy movie where they tour Holocaust, you know, camps? I mean, it's ridiculous to think about, but Eisenberg kind of pulls it off, I think. And Kieran Culkin, you know, he could be in the best actor mix for a nomination. I'm not really sure what the voters will think of this movie, but if anybody's going to emerge from this movie with a nomination, it's Kieran Culkin. I want to also mention a couple good supporting performances. Jennifer Grey. Yes, that Jennifer Grey from Dirty Dancing. She's on the tour group as well, a recently divorced Jewish woman from Los Angeles who's on the tour. Will Sharp is really good as the tour guide. He's an English-British tour guide. Very good tour guide, and he kind of has these weird interactions with Benji, who just is kind of disrupting the tour, if you can imagine that. So nice supporting performances. I think Eisenberg keeps the comedy coming, but also when those moments of tragedy come where you have to really realize how many of their relatives and fellow Jews were killed, it becomes poignant as well.
One thing I wondered about, Matt, is this is about a tour, right? And so we've all been on tours. I've been on tours in Europe. I've not been to concentration camps, and I hope to see that part of the world someday. I really do. And I also work with tour groups in Wyoming and work that I continue to do there, but they have a role in preserving history. And so did you feel that this was a tour that you might have found yourself on, or because of the comedic interjection, probably not?
Probably not. I think if you were on a quote unquote tour of Nazi atrocities, let's just put it that way, in Poland and Germany, you'd probably be part of a bigger group. There's like six people in the tour group. So Will Sharp, who plays James, he's leading basically six people around, an elderly couple, Jennifer Grey, a recent convert to Judaism who's from Africa, is on the tour group as well. And he's really an interesting character that kind of bonds with Benji. So you'd probably find yourself on a bigger group, but you know, he does take them to all kinds of sites, not just concentration camps, but you know, the Warsaw Ghetto, for example, they go visit that. And, I think a tour like this would be fascinating. I'm guessing you'd have a few more people on it. That's my guess. But in movies, as you know, Craig, sometimes they have composite characters and they limit the amount of characters. You know, having too many characters on screen at one time is tricky to juggle in a movie, I've always felt. So you sometimes see, for example, married couples in a movie, they just don't have kids because then you have to cast the kids, you know, things like that I noticed. So I think they kept the tour group small for movie purposes.
Matt, tomorrow, Wicked is released. Will this be the highest grossing movie of the year?
Oh boy. No, because Inside Out 2 is the juggernaut of 2024. So I don't think it's going to make that kind of money that Inside Out 2 made. Keep in mind, Gladiator 2 opens this weekend too, and the buzz on this is really good. So these two films are going to kind of piggyback off each other. We've talked about, can it be the Barbenheimer weekend of 2024? Some of the initial buzz I'm hearing on Wicked is this isn't going to be one of these movie musicals that everyone remembers. It looks like it's heavily CGI'd. I'm not sure about the casting with Cynthia Erivo and Ariana Grande. I could be very wrong on that. It's 160 minutes long. That could limit the box office as well, but I'll review Wicked first. How about we do that, Craig? And that'll be next week, and then we'll do Gladiator 2 after that, and we'll see if we have two Oscar contenders or not.
All right, Matt, let's do our Oscar trivia bit. We do that each and every Thursday here as we review movies. This actress won four Academy Awards that spanned decades from the 30s to the 80s. Who is it, and what Best Actress Academy Awards has she won?
Katharine Hepburn, Morning Glory, 1933. Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, 1967. She does the back-to-back, winning in 68 with The Lion in Winter opposite Peter O'Toole. And finally on Golden Pond, 1981. She's still the only actor or actress to win four Oscars.
Matt, of those four films, which is your favorite?
The Lion in Winter, for sure. Her and O'Toole have this acting battle going on, and O'Toole should have won Best Actor. Of his eight losses in that category, which became kind of a famous thing that they finally gave him an honorary Oscar as he was older. I think that's what he should have won for, as Henry II, battling it out with Hepburn. They became great pals for years after that, too.
We've been to the movies with Matt Olien. Matt, thanks for being with us again on Main Street.
You bet.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather around, everybody.
We've heard the walk-up music. It's time to review the news, as we do each and every week here on Main Street with our director of news, Dave Thompson. Welcome to Main Street.
Thanks, Craig. Good to be here.
Dave, let's get right to it. The Public Service Commission has approved a Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity for a $440 million power line from Jamestown to Ellendale. This is a pretty big deal.
It is a very big deal, and it's actually part of what they're calling a tranche of transmission in the MISO region, the Midwest Independent System Operator region. They're the transmission overseers. And this is a part of it. It's a $440 million project and for this high voltage power line. And it's being done by MDU and Otter Tail Power Company jointly. Now, they're saying, and the company's saying, it's going to relieve congestion. It's going to allow more of North Dakota's power to get to other places where it's needed because it's all part of the MISO system. There is some pushback from the chairman of the Public Service Commission who says he's not sure it's needed. And he hasn't been convinced that the line is needed. However, the vote was 2-1, so they're going to go ahead with the project.
And Dave, this is likely due to the fact that more power is needed to power computer servers for AI and for other reasons. Is that accurate?
Oh, yes, that's absolutely accurate. And, of course, Jamestown, you know, to Ellendale, they're building that Applied Digital down there. That's going to help supply power to Applied Digital. And, you know, digital farms are growing.
Dave, applications are available, and I'm using air quotes here, for the Out of the Ashes Wildfire Disaster Relief Program. What's that about?
Well, basically, after the wildfires destroyed a lot of acres and destroyed some farm buildings and outbuildings in northwest North Dakota, the Stockman's Association, the Stockman's Foundation, started a fundraising campaign. They put $50,000 of their own money into it. Now they've got over $700,000, and they're basically going to make it available to ranchers who suffered pretty heavy losses in those wildfires. That'll be available sometime in January.
Katie David, news reporter here at Prairie Public, reported on a story about the Missouri Valley Coalition for Homeless People in the Bismarck-Mandan area, and the numbers that she talked about are staggering. The group and the area has provided more than 42,000 nights of shelter.
Absolutely. And you think about that, 42,000 nights of shelter, that's a lot of homeless people or people who are temporarily homeless in the Bismarck-Mandan area. You're seeing that in other large locations in North Dakota. Fargo's got an issue. Grand Forks has an issue. Minot has an issue. But in the Bismarck-Mandan area, the Missouri Valley Coalition is working to try to end homelessness by helping these people find work, find temporary jobs at least, and find housing. And housing right now, of course, as is a statewide problem, is at a premium in terms of affordable housing.
Dave, do you sense that the problem is growing in the Bismarck-Mandan area?
I honestly do think it's growing, and I'm thinking it may be just a reflection of people moving to the area. And they might be moving from other parts of North Dakota, but they might be moving from other parts of the U.S. And they're moving to North Dakota, and they're moving to Bismarck, and they're finding themselves temporarily homeless. Plus, there's the other issue that needs to be talked about when you talk about the homeless. Some of these people are suffering from some mental illnesses and some addiction problems, and there is a real push in this area to provide more of those services to those people.
Dave, we probably have talked about property tax issues more than maybe any other topic as you and I have visited from week to week here on Main Street. As I was visiting with friends last night, I told them your headline that property tax is top of mind of legislators, and their response was, "Are you sure?" But yes, it does look like it's now certainly a legislative priority.
Well, it's not only a legislative priority, it's the priority of the new governor coming in. Kelly Armstrong says he believes property taxes has got to be the number one issue. They're all concerned that if they don't do something substantive to deal with the property tax issue, it'll be back on the ballot again in the future, and they're afraid it's going to pass, and that would hamstring some local governments. So what they're talking about is maybe property tax caps tied to the consumer price index or something, the index of inflation. They're talking about different types of valuations for property. There are a lot of potential solutions that will be talked about. I have a feeling this is going to be an overarching theme of the entire session to come.
Did I read where one of the proposals is for the legislature essentially to become, I use a quote here from your story, the traffic cops of property taxes for local political subdivisions?
Yes, and I heard that from a couple of the leaders in the House and Senate have said that maybe they have to do that because they're afraid that maybe in some instances local governments are relying too much on property taxes and property tax increases. I think the vast majority, personally, just talking to people, the vast majority of county, city, school districts, they all know that property tax is a real issue, and they hate to raise it, but they don't have a lot of options in terms of raising money at this point.
Speaking of money, Dave, a good sign for North Dakota. You've talked about this threshold of 1.2 million barrels of oil per day. The state has reached that threshold again.
Right, and that's been something they've been striving for since, you know, oil prices dove and production was ratcheted back, part of it due to COVID. And they're concerned that they wanted to get back to 1.2 million barrels a day at least. You know, we were number two in the nation. Then New Mexico passed us because of the Permian Basin oil. But North Dakota is still hanging in there, number three in the nation in terms of oil production. But, you know, they're looking for the future. They need 1.2 million barrels of oil at a minimum because some of the oil wells are going to run out of oil. And they need to have more production step up and take the place of that. They'd like to increase it further, and what policies may come out of Interior now that could be headed by Doug Burgum or Energy might, you know, have a real say on what happens there.
Thought it was interesting you noted that there were 111 new wells permitted in October. That's a big number.
It's a very big number, and they're saying they need about 100 per month if they can, because that will keep production steady. And, you know, we have to add into this mix that odd thing that, to me, about the Bakken oil is that as oil production goes down, natural gas production goes up. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. You've got oil that might be ratcheted back, natural gas goes up, and then you have a goal of 95% carbon capture, 95% capture of the flaring to reduce, you know, the amount of flaring in the atmosphere, and that's a state policy. So there's a lot of things at play. There's a lot of pieces to this puzzle.
Not a surprise, the state canvassing board has certified the election results. And I think it was noted that about 62% of eligible voters in North Dakota actually cast a ballot. What do you know about that?
Well, 62% has been about the average for North Dakota the last several years. So that was no surprise to them. But what was a surprise to the canvassing board is that actually more people voted early or by, you know, absentee ballot than actually went to the polls on election day. That happened again during COVID, but that was a different situation. People probably couldn't get to the election sites. But now we're seeing kind of a change in how North Dakotans are voting.
Dave, incoming North Dakota Governor-elect Kelly Armstrong has announced now that there will have new appointments and changes to his cabinet. Anything new for you to report there?
There's a couple of things that are extremely interesting to me. Number one, he selected a Democratic legislator, former legislator now, Corey Mock, to head the IT department. So that's causing a little, you know, raising of eyebrows among the Republicans. But he has said that he's looking for people who are competent. And Corey Mock is what you call kind of a moderate Democrat, got along well with the Republican majorities, and knows his IT. The other thing that is surprising to me, and I need to look into this a little bit more, is that Joe Morissette, who left as OMB director during Burgum's second term, is now coming back under Kelly Armstrong. I think that's very interesting.
Dave, the last story we'll chat about is the fact that North Dakota could earn an extra $30 million over the next year with changes to legacy fund investments. And that's because the threshold of spending from the legacy fund has dropped and there will be more money available for longer-term investments.
That's right. That's what the legislature tried to accomplish when they pass this constitutional initiative to get it on the ballot, is to make sure more money is saved by the legacy fund so that if oil starts, you know, ratcheting back and we're not getting as much oil taxes, there's money in the legacy fund going forward.
Dave, any new stories you and your group are working on that we should keep our eyes open for, or in this case, our ears open for?
Well, there's an odd one that I'm going to do. It's about North Dakota's coal mine reclamation program. And, you know, we know about strip mining in North Dakota, but in the early days, there were some underground mines. These old mines need to be reclaimed because you're starting to see sinkholes and roads collapse, and they're pouring some money into it. And we'll kind of explain it. It's been a long time story, but there's more money going into it now.
Dave Thompson, he's our news director here at Prairie Public, a position that he's held for quite a while, and we're glad that he's here.
Gather around, everybody.
Dave, thanks for joining us on Main Street.
You are so welcome, Craig.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public. This is Dakota Datebook for November 21st. On this date in 1906, in Wahpeton, the County Board of Commissioners authorized a warrant for the admission of Mary L. to the State Hospital for the Insane. Mary, a domestic worker, had been employed in the household of Dr. and Mrs. Meckstroth. Over several months, money and valuables had gone missing from the Meckstroth home, a diamond stud, other jewelry, and cash from the doctor's home office and his wife's pocketbook. Mrs. Meckstroth's watchdog had also died under mysterious circumstances. Though Mrs. Meckstroth thought highly of Mary, who came from a good family and was an excellent housekeeper, she began to suspect something was wrong. The missing items often appeared to have been taken during a break-in, with the house left in disarray. Eventually, Mrs. Meckstroth decided to set a trap. She placed an imitation diamond stick pin on her dresser the day after Dr. Meckstroth left for Europe. When she checked the next day, the imitation diamond was removed from its setting and money was missing from an upstairs bedroom. Mary denied any wrongdoing. The following day, Mrs. Meckstroth became violently ill, and Dr. Bates, who had been eating with the family, also fell ill. Mrs. Meckstroth was bedridden for 4 days. Each time she ate or drank something brought by Mary, she became sick again. Her young children were not affected. Concerned, Dr. Meckstroth had the county sheriff investigate, leading to Mary's arrest on charges of larceny. Upon questioning, it was revealed that Mary's actions went beyond theft. She confessed to poisoning Mrs. Meckstroth on 8 occasions, using rough-on-rats poison after first experimenting on dogs. She showed no emotion during the interrogation, stating she didn't know why she did it, but she would do it again if given the chance. It was only as she was being taken to jail that she screamed, cried, and fought. Once in jail, she collapsed and lay in a silent, seemingly semi-conscious state for several days. The County Insanity Commission conducted inquiry and adjudged that Mary was insane. She was committed to the hospital in Jamestown for 2 years. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lise Erdrick. I'm Merle Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Here's what one of our valued members told us about listening to Prairie Public during his commute.
All I can say is the days of chatter and giggling on the morning commute with conventional broadcasting, long gone. I prefer the quality, the variety, and the education on public radio. It's default. 80 to 90% of the time, I feel more and more like my mother, who wouldn't listen to anything other than public broadcasting. And now I know why. I support Prairie Public because I think it's reliable, it's fair. I just think it's quality, and I'm curious, and it informs me.
Join John and all the fine folks that power their listening enjoyment of Prairie Public. Go to prairiepublic.org and become a sustaining member today.
And that's a wrap for this Thursday edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, Jeremy Hobson, the host of The Middle, will discuss how research from The Middle affects us all. And at 7 p.m., we'll air Science Friday with Ira Plato. Coming Monday on Main Street, we'll visit with North Dakota State University professor Dr. Thomas Ambrosio. We'll discuss the current state of the war in Ukraine, particularly as the United States prepares for a new administration. What should we in North Dakota be thinking about relative to the war in Ukraine? And what about the nuclear saber rattling we're hearing from Russia? That's Monday, right here on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us. From all of us here at Prairie Public, we hope you have a great North Dakota weekend.